And now,
from the didgeridoo to 140 miles east of Kalamazoo, at least as far as Google Maps says, this version is a tribute to Motown.
Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
I hope you could hear the tail part of Dean's wild Bond villain laughter just now. This is Phil Lairness coming at you from Los Angeles, and if you did hear that laugh, you were hearing the Motor City Madman, Motown's very own Dean Haglund. How are you, Dean?
Hey, I'm excellent. Thank you for asking. I assume your eyes are now 100%. You can see around the world.
I can see around the world. I have become the man with the X-ray eyes. Yeah,
oh.
They're good. They are really good. I mean, there's some bizarre phenomena occasionally, but even outdoor, you know, some flickers, some strangeness occurs from time to time that, you know, is, I guess, always going to be there, and it's just things my brain rewires itself to work through.
Right.
But nighttime seeing is a lot better. I drove at night for the first time in 6 months. Really? 6 months,
wow.
Maybe. And that was a good test. So all is well. And yet I can't help wondering about the friend we leave behind. I don't know. That was a quote from Star Trek.
Your cloudy, horrible eye lenses.
For some reason, I started thinking about Spock on the Genesis planet. But okay. But Dean Haglund, you were traveling. And
I
so wanted to go and meet you in Knoxville because it's one of my very favorite places. And I couldn't because I still have not been cleared for flight with the new peepers. The pressure, the air pressure, you don't know. So anyway, so I guess within a matter of a week or so, I have not my final appointment, but my final kind of clearance that, yep, you got a clean bill of health on those eyes. So you can live normally, and then I'll be free of medications, free of eye drops and everything like that. So I want to live vicariously through you. You were in Knoxville for, is it Alien Expo or UFO Expo?
Alien Expo, way different than a UFO Expo.
Oh, yes, indeed.
You know, it's a subtlety that only the true.
It turns out that it was a rally about building that wall, is what you went to.
No,
because they are supporters.
No, there was
there.
Many researchers from around, including who did I hang out with? There was Tom Reed and Dr. Stephen Barrett was there, and all sorts of the big aficionados from all the shows, the NASA Files Unexplained, all that kind of stuff.
Andrew Goff,
he sat right beside me and we hung out.
And did you talk about how he stars in The Truth Is Out There too?
I said we are editing a second one, but I wasn't sure if he was in it or not.
I'm cutting his piece right now.
Oh my gosh! I'm gonna give him a hey ho on WhatsApp and
he's
say there.
So
you go.
Good, yeah. He's just a really fun, fascinating, sweet man too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like his regular day job is fascinating. So, That's cool.
Which is sitting next to you at immigration rallies.
This is not an it's about UFOs and things.
Are you
But anyway,
sure
Knoxville was lovely.
Yeah. Okay. So tell me about Knoxville. Yeah. Okay.
So yeah. So the lively center square, the market square, full of live free bands and music and people walking in the streets. And I was also in a documentary about improv comedy, because the longest running improv group, it's a troupe that's been together for 25 years, the Einstein Brothers, with the same three original founding members, were performing at their 25th anniversary show on the Tuesday, even though I left on the Monday. So I couldn't stick around for that. But it's pretty phenomenal to hear any improv troupe make it out for 25 years. And they've done it in Knoxville. So the documentarian filmmaker, John Hude, took me around, showed me the city. I had a less than stellar Tennessee cheesesteak. I can't recommend that. Everything else was delicious, but not that.
No, you're in the South. Why wouldn't you eat Southern food, for crying out loud?
Well, that's the thing. The menu didn't have... I thought this was like, oh, it's a Tennessee cheesesteak. They've done some Southern slant to the Philadelphia cheesesteak.
Yeah, and in fact, so why would but why would you care about that? That's the point. Like, are you going to go to Philadelphia and go, oh, interesting, they've done a Northern slant on grits? No. Yeah. That's ridiculous. Yeah. You know.
Now you say that was ridiculous.
I told you that.
Jumped off the page, off the menu.
I told you to get in touch with Uncle Harry. I told you to do this.
I know.
The food and the alcohol, I mean, the speakeasies this guy knows about.
Well, there was a speakeasy with a red light over the alley entrance, the whole nine yards. I saw that. We didn't go in, but I saw it.
Well, I bet you enjoyed that tremendously. All right. I'm not going to lie. I'm not so much angry as I'm disappointed.
I'll say it was a disappointing trip. I should have had a better time.
Knoxville, I mean, you're surprised by the improv. You know, this is a city that has a river running right through the middle of it, and I don't know what that means, except I like saying it. And and it's got a university, the University of Tennessee, right there in the heart of it, on the river, and beautiful federal courthouse, amazing old theaters.
1909, the Bijou was there.
And there's the Tennessee Theater.
And Tennessee, fully renovated.
Oh, my goodness. And neither of these allow you to bring handguns in. So, because it says it right there, there's the no handgun logo. So, I mean, that's what you want in a historic theater. And, but yeah, the art scene.
How would you reenact?
And the movie scene. I mean, there's a movie theater chain headquartered there. There's a film distribution company's headquartered there. I don't think the secret is out yet, but I think it's going to be Knoxville. Knoxville's a comer. It's going to be in your face.
It's no longer scruffy, as the 1982 World's Fair was. A reporter from New York Times said, how's this scruffy town get the World's Fair?
Yeah.
And now everything is, they use that moniker proudly. Scruffy Knoxville.
That Sunsphere is kind of cool, though.
Yeah, it is. And free. You can go up there and see the whole town for free. Yeah. I was right beside it.
All right. As you know, I'll save this story for some other time, actually. All right. I want to know, though, because you were in a documentary about improv and you are teaching improv. How's that going?
Fantastic. Got a great group. We are going through the class is morphing a bit, not just from a narrative thing, but gone to it turns out a couple of students said that the Detroit improv scene is kind of a lot of talking heads. So I'm endeavoring to bring physical comedy and train physical comedy as part of the narrative thing to bring it all together.
I feel like the answer you just gave me was a demonstration of yes anding. I do, because I feel like my true reporting of the answer might have been different. That's all I'm saying. I would have no-butted my way through it. And
yes and is not – yes and is a a terribly misunderstood trope of improv, and that we should sort of throw that out a little bit.
Wow, good for you.
Yeah, because in narrative, you kind of need, you know, boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl as your narrative arc. That losing the girl part needs some sort of not yes and bit to happen. So,
well, I don't know. That's not true. You're saying yes to the obstacles, and you're adding to them, and you're doubling down on them. That's
right,
the problem.
They're
obstacles. And this gets back to actually conversations we have about just artists and filmmakers and all of this all the time. Saying yes to obstacles, saying yes to restrictions. And I feel like a lot of times improv shows, they take yes and to mean the path of least resistance, and that's not what it is.
Exactly. Yeah, you don't just run around and tag the bases. You challenge yourself to harder and harder.
Yeah, say yes to the obstacles because the obstacles might be where the story actually is.
Exactly. Yeah,
that's good. Yeah. That's good. Well, that's, you know, Nikki Monty from Truth Is Out There. You know, she once, we were talking about this, you know, like, I forget what they called it, but remember there was all sort of self-help groups that were all about saying yes. Jim Carrey even made a comedy about this, right? Like, say yes to everything. And, and you know, she said it's, you know, we were just talking about it, and she said, you know, the thing that it ignores is that a healthy no is a no because you're saying yes to something else.
Ah.
You know,
well, that's going to come up in next week's class.
It's not that you're saying no to that extra slice of cheesecake. It's that you're saying yes to feeling good tomorrow morning or, you know, or to being healthier or what have you. You know,
because
people will use the, oh, we're supposed to say yes, not just in improv, but in life to the sloppiest behavior.
Exactly. And yeah, and then it's like you're considered incorrect if you are saying no to something that you deem to be less well, or yeah, like you say, be saying yes to the result, the outcome by having an obstacle. So
yeah, and that's it. It's supposedly narrative improv, and I think a lot of times it's about the easy joke. Where's the easy joke? Where's the easy turn that I can make to generate laughs? Instead of, or to be funny, or to be, that's what I'm saying yes to, instead of, I'm going to keep saying yes to exploring this story.
Right. And so there's the very famous Family Guy episode where they make an improv troupe, and all Peter Griffin does is a terrible John Wayne impersonation for big laughs. And, you know, regardless of what narrative they're trying to set up or what scene, he comes and goes, I'm John Wayne. And that I use as an example every time of what is wrong with improv.
That's from Family Guy?
Yeah, there's a Family Guy episode.
And do your students ask, which question do they ask first? What's Family Guy or who's John Wayne? Which one do they ask first? All right.
Everybody seen that episode?
Hey, let's do a live event of the week.
Yay!
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
Annually, I am part of a bowl gang. Not as in people who go bowling, but people who go to the Hollywood Bowl. And the core four of us are Lily, Aaron Petrulis, myself, and our host with the most, John Girodo.
Oh, of course.
And this year, the delightful Pat McNeely, Patricia McNeely, of course, who was such an important part of the wedding, reading the response to the letter to the Corinthians in our wedding. She accompanied us, and we saw a night of Russian composers at the Bowl. But the centerpiece of it was a production of Peter and the Wolf. And this production told the story. It was read by and acted by, because he interacted and just did a delightful job. John C. Reilly.
Wow, what?
And we didn't know that John C. Reilly was going to be a part of it. And the thing is, and I shouldn't be surprised by this. I, you know, and yet I was. I'll admit to being surprised by this. He was so delightful. It mattered so much to him. And I say I shouldn't be surprised because the guy's a pro. When has he ever phoned it in? And of course, he loves theater. He loves musicals. He love, you know, and the thing that was so great was he's been in musicals. Is he a great dancer? No, of course not. Is he a great singer? No, of course not. But what he has is a professional's timing.
Ah, fantastic.
And as the narrator, how important is that when you have not only the orchestra that you're working with, but in this case, you have every role either performed by ballet dancers in these extraordinary costumes and headpieces, or puppets playing the parts, being manipulated by dancers and extraordinary puppeteers. And and the entire bowl, the lower sections of the bowl, were the stage. I mean, they were coming in and out of the audience. It was it was also sometimes choreographed for the camera, where they were laying flat on their backs on the bowl stage.
Oh. Busby Berkeley.
Yeah, because you could only see that part of the set design that was on the floor via the camera. Anyway, it was, it was, you know, they put so much into this for one night, a one night performance. And it was the most magical production I've ever seen there, and maybe anywhere, but certainly there. So one for the time capsule. Thank you, John Giroto. Thank you, Hollywood Bowl. The Bowl Gang does it again.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. Was this filmed for posterity or anything?
It was. I think what you wanted to say was it filmed for prosthetics? And
there were
prosthetic surgeries going on to the side of the stage during the. I don't know, but I hope not.
Oh. Right,
live performing, ephemeral, and you know what? A blissfully few people trying to record with their phones or taking photos, because it's just gotten so bad. But fortunately, the people who were there knew enough to go to a live event and shut off their phones, not just so they don't make a sound, but so that the screens don't light up, because that's very distracting to audience members. And because it's unnecessary, as we are all grown adults and therefore capable of living in and enjoying the moment. And I include in the group of adults all the little kids around me who sat at rapt attention during the 2 hours of Russian music.
Oh, fantastic.
And why wouldn't they? Because they know that those Russian composers are going to influence our election. Okay. Where do we go next?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, I guess we should just mention, thank again, our guest on last week's show, Robert Nichols, professor of documentary film. We learned so much about the history of documentary while also celebrating the life of the late great documentarian D.A. Pennebaker. And Robert, of course, as I mentioned, I met through the Los Angeles Breakfast Club. He's a good ham and egger, a loyal breakfast clubber. And that reminded me, Dean, that you may want to make a trip to town this week, because this week at the Breakfast Club, and I don't plug this very often anymore on this show, but Suzanne Lloyd, the granddaughter of the late, great silent film comedian Harold Lloyd. Will present a portion of her father's collection of 3D photographs. No one was more into the development and the exploration and the archiving of the art of 3D than Harold Lloyd.
Now, this is the type that used the two pictures sort of side by side, stereoscopic,
which is the original kind of photography.
Exactly. And it has the two lenses as situated the same distance apart as your eyes.
But I think that he had, I think many different technologies related to 3D. he explored and he archived. I believed. I'll find out. I'll report back to you. But, I mean, there's many stories about, you know, the 3D nude portraits he would take of Playboy Playmates and things like this at the parties at his house.
Wow.
But his collection of 3D photographs totals more than 200,000 3D photographs. And Suzanne has devoted her life to film preservation ever since her grandfather made her the trustee of his film and 3D photograph library at the age of 19 back in 1971. And she continues to keep her grandfather's films alive by sharing his work with the world. She'll be doing so at the forthcoming CineCon, the annual film festival in Hollywood that shows what we can call, I guess, obscure classic films, obscure in that they're not available on home video.
Right.
Not that they weren't successful, weren't groundbreaking, weren't quality movies, but for whatever reason, they've slipped through, often because there weren't maybe the quality of materials to be able to generate a home video release, because as we know, so many films weren't well preserved. And so she'll be there and highlighting some of Harold Lloyd's work, and I know he's a favorite of yours. So
yeah, absolutely. In fact, I've seen her introduce a film at the Orpheum Theater on Broadway, The Kid, I think it was, Harold Lloyd's feature-length silent film.
Wait, I thought The Kid was Chaplin. The Kid is Harold Lloyd?
There is The Kid is a Chaplin film, and then there's another Harold Lloyd film similar to that, but is it also called The Kid? I am now cheating and going.
You don't want to don't get confused between those. Because imagine how upset you'll be if you think you're going to see Harold Lloyd's The Kid and you end up getting Chaplin's The Kid. You're going to be outraged.
Outraged. I know. One, you know, the pathos and oh my gosh. So anyway, she came to the Orpheum, had many stories of Harold Lloyd's antics. Is it antics? I guess. And also that... you know, she pointed out, amazingly, he did a lot of his own stunts, even though he lost his finger and thumb in a firecracker accident at a very young age and wore a rubber glove.
Whoa.
That you have to look to see, because it's so unbelievably well hidden that even in Safety Last, you notice that he's hanging from his left hand more often than his right.
Wow.
So, I know.
All right.
Now
let me. Sorry, ask
the movie's called The Kid Brother. There's your change.
Kid Brother. All right.
Yes.
Now let me ask you this before we move on. And again, this is the sort of stuff one can Google, I would imagine. But I've got you in front of me electronically, so why not ask you?
Yes.
Harold Lloyd, did he make a transition into sound film, into talkies?
Did.
Okay.
Yes, he did. In fact, there is. A movie, 1936, called The Milky Way, where he's a milkman. That's actually pretty damn funny. And his voice kind of matched his personality. I think that was always the thing. You know, many of the silent film stars, you assume their voice, Jack Gilbert being the most famous, that he's a dashing leading man. His voice would be a deep baritone as opposed to a reedy, thin tenor. And so a lot of careers were washed away just by the sound of their voice. And many a voice teacher got a lot of work around that transition time as everybody was trying to train their voice to match their look.
I just started to laugh internally because after you answered the question, I could almost hear our loyal listener, Maurice Terenzio, who has not written in a while, and I'm sure because he knows that reading has been difficult for me, but I could hear his fingers on the keyboard beginning, Phil, Phil, Phil. How could you not know that Harold Lloyd made the transition? You know, and I imagine it'll be an email with several links to... either films short or feature length that I can enjoy in part or in whole online. I would imagine that he'll be doing that. And I will welcome that email. Now that I am back among the seeing, among the sight.
Well, you know, he also would then became an avid producer in the Little Rascals series, the R Gang, with Alfalfa and Buckwheat and Spanky.
Yes,
all that.
I have learned a lot about his, again, his non-acting work through various conversations. You know, Eric Kurland, the founder of 3D Space, the 3D Museum, you know him. He's the expert on the history of 3D in Los Angeles. He's become a Breakfast Club member, and I've enjoyed many wonderful conversations with him about film history. And so I've learned a lot about Harold Lloyd, but I just suddenly realized that as an actor, I just so identify him with those silent classics and didn't know. Whereas, of course, the story of Buster Keaton, maybe because of Sunset Boulevard, but the story of Buster Keaton and his kind of fall from grace and then late career sort of comeback is,
right.
I think, fairly well known. But Harold Lloyd, maybe because he was such a successful producer and businessman, and so there wasn't such a staggering fall for him, the story of him as a performer just isn't indelibly etched into my mind.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm trying to think, well, it depends on, you know, your viewing habits and how much interest you have in it. So yeah, Buster Keaton, it's resurgence too. I'm thinking about that. So I guess. Anyway, we table that, shall we?
All right.
For a longer conversation.
So you know what we've been doing, Dean, up until last week was we had introduced a new segment that I was calling Segment of Futures Past, and we'll have to get, if we keep doing this, and I think we should, but we have to get a new sting, a new introductory soundbite for segment. But we're not going to do, we didn't do a clip last week, and we're not going to do one this week, largely because, I'll just tell you what was going on 12 years ago and why I don't want to revisit it, except in passing. But Chill Pack Hollywood Hour number 17, 12 years ago, we welcomed our first ever guest.
Oh.
And that was the extraordinarily talented Philip Newby. Who killed himself in early 2009. So honestly, I don't want to, we've played clips from that in the past on an anniversary show. That show is available at chillpackhollywood.com, and we continue to rebuild that site with more and more shows from the vault. But I don't need to hear that. But the one thing that I do remember quite clearly was Phil had become an avid listener of the show from the very beginning, and he had a topic that he wanted us to discuss, centered in part around science fiction, but also it could have included non-science fiction, non-genre films, and just film in general. But it was the way that time gets played with in film, and often what those films are saying about our concept of time. And I do kind of find it interesting that that was on his mind, but it was a fascinating topic, we thought. And so we said, yes, and you should be on it, setting this up. And Dean, I bring it up because I've been rewatching. You know, I made a short list of like 50-something films from the past decade that I wanted to rewatch in anticipation of us making our best of the decade list.
Right.
And then trying to catch some films that maybe had slipped through the cracks. But I've been watching several sci-fi entries of late, including Twin Peaks: The Return and Denis Villeneuve's Arrival. And I really am struck by how much more than ever time as the subject matter is very much in the forefront of a lot of science fiction.
Is that true?
And, you know, Arrival not only held up really, really well, but maybe even was better and more moving. And what I loved is it's the case that proves my rant about our spoiler culture. You know, don't spoil anything, don't spoil anything. Right. Whereas a great movie, right, can't be spoiled. That we live in a time where every movie seemingly has to have a twist ending.
Right.
But rare is the movie that the twist ending, if you see it coming, if you figure it out in advance, it doesn't matter. That when it comes, yeah, it still emotionally resonates so deeply. That just because you can figure it out doesn't mean you'll really be able to know how that development emotionally will affect characters that you hopefully actually care about. And you might not even realize how much you care about them until this moment occurs that affects them so dramatically. And the truth is, now knowing the film and knowing the plot and knowing all of it, Arrival only gets more affecting, more haunting.
Really? Fantastic.
As a great movie should, right? Whether it be science fiction or not. And and what I love about it, being able to say that about Arrival, is here is a movie that really talks about our evolution needs to be based on freeing ourselves from concept of past, present, future, and realizing that all of time exists right now.
Right. This fluidity. And that different bubble universes, the soap bubble theory of parallel universes, is that the time is intermingled throughout all the soap bubbles.
And truthfully, so anyone who's lived long enough, and especially if you've lived long enough and have been fortunate enough to pursue passions, things that you feel will connect you to ideas, concepts larger than yourself, you realize that, yes, of course, past creates the future. That's one idea, but also the future that we can sense for ourselves is a seed that's already planted. And so it's that future that grows our present. And so anyway, it's just really, really cool to realize that the film is not only about these concepts, but it truly embodies and proves these concepts.
Yeah.
You know?
Cool is that?
What you and I were really fascinated by. We can't take credit for it except for hard work and the willingness to really discover. But what we thought was so cool and what I think in some ways was the fuel for that hard work was realizing that there was a way to take these concepts of quantum consciousness that people were talking about and the truth is out there and structurally create a film that embodied that quantum approach, quantum consciousness in structure. And so it's really fun when a movie does embody and proves the very themes it's exploring and expressing.
Love it. I'm going to watch Arrival again, damn it. I loved it the first time, but now that you say all these things, and it's true, you can't spoil a great movie.
Yeah.
Even if you tell, I guess is a thing.
I am somebody who tries to figure movies out. I'm really constantly trying to figure them out. Not always, but oftentimes, and for a variety of reasons that we won't get into. But therefore, often a second time I come to a movie, it's more of, oddly enough, an adventure of exploration for me into the world that's created. Because I'm open to it more fully. Once whatever that need and that curiosity has been fulfilled in me the first time, often probably to know that I'm not wasting my time.
Right.
And I'm determined not to waste my time, as you know, because I think I can learn something from any movie that I watch, no matter how quote unquote bad we might say that it is. I can learn something from it.
Yeah.
And,
right.
And
to do it.
So I'm actively participating in that way. I don't mean trying to figure it out always by going, okay, this is what that character is going to do. This is what that's going to, but there's a degree to that, but I'm, you know, trying to assess, okay, this is why these characters are doing this, because the writers, the directors, the producers have been locked into this set of choices.
Yes. I know. I call that armchair directing. And when you armchair direct, it's fun, because you are, in theory, working out problems and solutions that you would do differently. That's what I always look at. How is this thing put together? Where would I have put that scene instead of where they put it?
Or
how does this?
Or why didn't they see it? And how is that maybe a blind spot? How is that an obstacle that you can either say yes to or that you can see coming? Because it's difficult. It's difficult
Absolutely.
To be aware of all these things, and then you get stuck in the editing room sometimes, going, "Oh my God, what do we do?" So
I wish I could get I could re-edit Basketball Diaries, Leonardo DiCaprio's descent into drug fueled, whatever, because that was, I think, cut so incorrectly. There was a way more deeply emotionally resonant way of doing it than linear timeline. And it makes me sad every time I see it come up anywhere, going, that movie could have been amazing were it cut differently instead of in just a sequential order.
Fascinating. Okay. I want to chat briefly with you about two indie films that I have seen recently, one a few weeks ago that we didn't get to. Because the leads in them are really, really good comedic performers, and we like to celebrate comedy performers and hope that they get to make more comedy movies. And they both happen to be women, and they're both women of Asian American descent. So that's very exciting to me, because this is a certain amount of underrepresentation, I think we could agree to, through the years, right? One of these, which I missed when it was in theaters in June, it's out now on disc. It's been available all summer long on demand, and I recommend it, believe it or not. It's, even though it's a romantic comedy, but maybe especially I'm recommending it because it's a romantic comedy, because it's been Dean Haglund who's held my feet to the fire to say, remember, yes, the tropes, but there's a reason they became tropes, because they can be satisfying stories, especially for those who maybe haven't seen as many movies as I have.
Right.
But also when they're represented differently, right? Life can be breathed into these tropes by each generation and by different groups of people. And so there's a romantic comedy called Plus One. It stars Maya Erskine. She has a television show that I've never heard of. So this is the first time I'm coming to her. She stars in it with Jack Quaid, who plays her best friend. And they decide to team up during wedding season. They're 20-somethings. Everyone they know is getting married, because the 30s are fast approaching. So they better do it, you know, because wedding season and Logan's Run sure have a lot in common. But I just want to, and it's funny, and again, you know what the tropes are, you know, the friends are going to end up realizing, wait, it was you all along, and then one of them's going to get cold feet, and the other one's going to go back to their previous one, and obstacles will ensue, and there's part of you that's going, you know, these aren't really obstacles, right? There's part of you going, why are we wasting our time? These aren't really obstacles, though, of course. The silliness of what we human beings put in our path to obstruct from being in love and being happy is sort of ridiculous. So there's something to that. But I just really want to focus on just how refreshing, how real, how funny, how moving this Maya Erskine is.
I
guess you rightly poked some fun at me through the years for saying that we need to have romantic comedies, if only because we have Hugh Grant. And he needs to be able to do something, goddammit. But this gal, you know, until she starts asking for the laughs instead of asking to be loved, I would see her in any romantic comedy that she does.
Okay. Yeah, right. Because she's amazing.
She's really, really fun. And I would say that her comedic chemistry, especially with Jack Quaid, is so good. And is there anything more believable for a couple of people who were supposed to believe are falling in love or are attracted to each other? Is there anything more believable than seeing two people who actually make each other laugh?
See, that's romantic right there. You never see that in a romantic comedy.
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe you don't. You infrequently... though I think it's changing, and I think in some part it's changing through comedies that feature maybe African American casts and now Asian American casts. You're starting to see where women are being allowed in the romantic comedies to be every bit as funny. Now, I think throughout history there are exceptions, right? I mean, your Goldie Hawns,
right?
You know, but often the romantic comedy is structured with woman as object, no matter how big a star she is, and she might get some funny lines, but it's the man that's funny.
Right. It happened one night. Clark Gable, Claudette Colbert. She has funny lines, but in the end, it's his movie.
Yeah, I really found that movie distasteful. But one of the reasons, now that you're saying it, that I realize I did is because the movie wants to have it both ways. He's the funny one, and yet he's also the serious one in the sense of being a person of substance. She's neither funny nor does she have substance. She's, in fact, depicted to be kind of flighty.
Right. And objectified.
Yeah. Not and objectified. Yeah. Yeah. But the recipe. And so I guess that's it. That is the danger, is that recipe, even toned down, that recipe runs throughout many romantic comedies, even ones I enjoy. Notting Hill, which you have to love or you're not allowed to watch movies anymore. Everything we just described is kind of true. A change is that he's not a person of the greatest substance, Hugh Grant's character. They're both somewhat flighty. But all of what we just described is there. She's kind of a silly, flighty character and an object. Not silly, not flighty, a person of substance, a wonderfully intelligent, sharp, funny person. What could be more attractive than that? Maya Erskine. And because she's a person of such substance, I would argue, also it, for much of the film, renders her an unbelievable romantic object, and that's why they don't get together until they do get together. So anyway, plus one, if you like romantic comedies, if you're looking for a romantic comedy, if you want to see a couple really, really gifted young actors who have comedic chops, there's one for you. And also, I got to say, a bonus is Ed Begley Jr. playing Jack Quaid's dad. I'm a big Ed Begley Jr. fan since way back. If you have him in a supporting role, you've already got one star from me on a scale of 1 to 4. So there you go.
Fantastic. Okay.
So that was one. And then the other one, and we haven't talked about this young lady before, a rapper from Queens originally, who has made a name for herself, at least in my eyes, stealing really kind of crappy big budget movies. now gets to be the lead in her own independent film, and it is drawing great reviews. I think it's doing very well at the box office, released by A24, so you know it's going to get an awards push. It's The Farewell from director Lulu Wang, and it stars Awkwafina as basically Lulu Wang, and it involves a story about a woman born in... born in Asia, raised in New York, whose family has to go back to China to say goodbye to their grandmother, who is dying, terminal illness. But it's part of Asian culture not to tell the person that's dying that they're dying if there's nothing that can be done about it. Indeed, even the medical practitioners are in on the lie and will come up with alternative fictional diagnoses. Just take this medication. Just do this. Because what's the point? And so in order to go and say goodbye, they have to concoct rapidly a wedding, another reason. You know, it's another reason that the whole family is visiting for the first time in years. So they basically force a young member of the family to get married to his girlfriend that he's only been seeing for a couple of weeks.
Hilarious.
And is that... It's funny at times, but it's really sad and it's very real. But the payoff, Dean, is so wonderful and so inspiring, and it's a deceptively profound movie. This is one I don't want to spoil, but I will say stay for the credits, because
wow,
you
really?
Don't get to find out the real point, the real message of the movie.
Is in the credits.
It's in the credits. It's something that's shown during the credits. Yeah.
Wow.
So, but this Awkwafina, Dean, she's hosted Saturday Night Live. I'm not quick to the party on this. but like I said, she's been stealing big budget movies that I don't think are very good. And there's an art to that, and that's how a lot of people get discovered throughout Hollywood history. Right? You know, oh my God, you've been really good in these B pictures. And so let's put you in a supporting role in an A picture and see how you do, right? That's it. But she's the real deal. And her performance is so good. I've liked her in everything that I've seen, but it's nice when you get to really enjoy a performer in a good film, because like we say, how can you know how good they are if the movie's not working?
Right, exactly. You would never know, because you have to guess at their potential. Or, and like armchair direct going, ah, if she wasn't saddled with that camera angle or this choice or that thing, then, you know, you would really see it shine. So,
or what often happens, right? Performances get celebrated in movies that don't work, because the actor might be consciously pushing against the grain, going, this thing isn't going to work, so I'm going to do this, and I'm going to stand out, and I'm going to be unintended by the director and the producer and the writer, maybe, but I'm going to be comic relief, and the audience is going to love me for it. But maybe the film might have worked better if you had put all that energy towards rowing the boat in the direction it was going, but instead you got laughs and you got our attention by rowing against the current.
Right. Interesting. Okay.
So
now
anyway,
we got to see both these things.
Yeah, I really am a fan of both of these ladies. So, and it's been a while since I think I've gone on record and saying, hey, these are two people for us to really keep an eye on.
Okay. You have not said that in some time, and your batting average on that is, I'm going to say,
it's pretty good. It's pretty good.
It's
That's
pretty
all
good.
It has to be. That's all it has to be. It's pretty good. All right. Hey, I think we got time to get to a few different items here. A little bit of a grab bag.
Okay.
We have an
Let's
email from a listener.
Yay.
Sent to us, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. People should feel free to send us emails, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. If we find it interesting and we have something to add, there's a chance we'll read it on the show. It's one of the things we say we mean when we say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
Right there.
It begins, hello, Dean and Phil.
Hey, that's us.
Forgive me if this is incorrect because I haven't seen the movie, but at, and it's a certain time, in the show. It doesn't matter. I stated that the LaBianca murders occurred the night before the Tate murders. This is an email referring to us discussing Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Ah, yes. Right.
And this listener, our friend in podcasting, Patrick B., he points out that the baby, the Tate baby, was killed first. Then the LaBianca murders. Anyway, he's saying that I got the order wrong in it, and it's entirely possible that I misspoke and did get the order wrong because we were doing the best we could not to spoil anything while still addressing a point that I thought was very important, which is the danger and maybe in this case for me, the kind of appalling approach to playing fast and loose with history for the purposes of just popcorn entertainment. And but I'm glad that Patrick sent the correction because it makes it easier for me to illustrate the point that I was trying to make, which is if you alter history, if you alter the timeline by saying that this doesn't happen, and then the way that it doesn't happen, nothing after it happened as it did, you right. then are basically, you're denying any reference, any acknowledgement of the other victims, because indeed there are no other victims in the new timeline. And what I was suggesting was, isn't that kind of whitewashing? And we were comparing it to Inglourious Bastards, where obviously right. the end of the war ends quite differently. The war in Germany ends quite differently. But the people who died die. The end of the war comes, it's the how that's different. In this case, I was proposing that. I was saying why it offends me in part is because you're denying a whole lot of pain and suffering that an entire community of people felt.
Yeah. Ben, I don't know if that is, it's a fairy tale, and the object of fairy tale isn't to deny you pain and suffering. It is to transform pain and suffering into hope. And
which is what he does for Sharon Tate and for the Tate family.
Right.
Ignoring altogether the LaBiancas. Because that came after, but there is no after anymore. So you're not transforming anything. You're just denying them anything.
Right.
Even mention. And so, and then you add to it the reality that, let's face it, there's going to be a lot of people who are never going to even know, even if they know that this is alternative history, they're never, ever even going to know about the LaBiancas because, they weren't in the Tarantino movie.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, and you take that as historical record.
To a degree we do. Yeah. And it just makes it harder to be remembered. And so it's a tricky point, but one of the inspirations Tarantino had was he thought that the victims should be the star of the story, not the murderers. That in history we remember the murderers and not the person they killed. And that is a very wise, it seems to me, observation, and yes. something that we ought to figure out if we can change to let those who might have the impulse to kill to know you will be forgotten. No one will know you.
Right.
And the people that will be celebrated, the people that will be celebrated and remembered forever are those you're seeking to destroy.
Right. The heroes, the true heroes.
Yeah. You will only make their light shine brighter if we could. And that's what he's trying to do. But in so doing, he ensures far more that some of those victims will never be known.
Yeah.
So that's right. that's the difficulty that I have there. So anyway, Patrick, thank you for the correction, because I think you actually helped me make my point more clearly. Maybe.
Maybe.
Not less clearly, anyway. Hey, so Dean, a couple stories that we've been following. One, Paramount, the CBS Viacom remerger finally came through, agreed to this last week on Tuesday, a $12 billion deal to reunite that brings back together under one roof not only Paramount and CBS, but such well-known brands as MTV, Nickelodeon, and Showtime. So this is kind of exciting to me, because I would like Paramount to have money to release movies again.
Yes.
It's just shocking how often, if I want to watch a great movie from the 70s or the 80s, it's a Paramount movie. And then you get into the last 10, 15 years. And, you know, going back to 2008, when Paramount released the fourth Indiana Jones film and Iron Man, they were the first studio. Well, they had reached $1 billion at the box office in a year, earlier than any studio ever had before. And yet by fall, they were out of money to release movies. And so that won't happen again. I like to think that they'll have a healthier, larger, more diverse slate. They'll be able to promote those movies, release those movies. But more importantly, even for the parent company, they are now positioned to be able to compete with the Disney Pluses, with the Netflixes, with the Amazon Primes, because they can have a synergy between their divisions, both for releasing, promoting, exploiting their product, but also cross-pollinating their product. Star Trek, the TV and movie universes are now under one umbrella again, and they can actually have some kind of synthesis in their storytelling.
Hooray! So this is a good deal.
I think so. I'm excited. As a Star Trek fan, one of the things that I've been clamoring for in a very quiet voice is, you know, revisit Deep Space Nine, for crying out loud. This was a show that had as much viewership as Next Generation when it was on, and it gets kind of second-class treatment. I mean, it got almost twice as many viewers as Voyager, and the story really lent itself to revisiting years later. And I've always been advocating, why not a mini series of it? And I would be surprised if such a thing does not come about. A Deep Space Nine mini series for a new, well, it doesn't need to be new. It would probably be CBS, because they own the CBS All Access streaming service now. So I bet we would get something like that in the hopper pretty darn soon.
That would be awesome. Can't wait.
All right.
What are we doing?
The other story, Dean, that we were talking about was, speaking of Netflix, their effort to buy, although when I say effort, it may have already been closed behind closed doors in secret, but Netflix's effort to buy the Historic Egyptian Theater, which had been sold to the nonprofit American Cinematheque for $1. We got into all the ways that the American Cinematheque financially was in trouble and how they might need this deal, right? Because it would give them a cash influx. And a lot more details have come out, how Netflix really wants this, you know, to have their splashy red carpet premieres for their award season hopefuls. And I got to tell you, I looked at a list of all the Oscar hopefuls that are still to come out. And virtually half of them are Netflix films.
Really?
Yeah, it's stunning. And so they won.
And their war horses increased from $8 to $13 billion in production budget, which I don't know, other than Apple, who's got that kind of a war chest to outpace them?
And so they need to show these at, you know, theatrically. They need to have theatrical exhibition to be qualify. And why not do it in your own theater?
Right.
So that was their plan, was to program in the theater. So many misgivings about this. You know, I would like to see them released to theaters so that, as you know, people would have an option to see if these movies are good enough to be award considered, then they're movies that theoretically are best seen on the big screen. And again, I feel everybody should watch a movie however they want to watch a movie. But
yeah,
that means you should have the choice on how you want to watch a movie. And with these Netflix movies, unless you're pretty much in LA, maybe San Francisco, maybe New York, but in those cities at a certain time, you will never get a chance to see these movies on a big screen. And some of them are better. And yeah, and certainly people would enjoy them more because that's how they like seeing movies. So so I would rather see them do that. But with The Egyptian itself, it's really scary because they had planned to fast track this to get the theater ready for their splashy awards presentations this fall. And it's like, who are they kidding? How could this happen? This is a historic building. Retrofitting it, that's a painstaking process. And right, I don't know if you can install a state-of-the-art Atmos, Dolby Atmos speaker system. That ceiling will not support those heavy speakers.
Yeah.
So,
and correct me if I'm wrong, it still has that interior steel girder infrastructure built within the walls.
Yes.
But it doesn't go across the ceiling, though. So if for them to do that, they would just put a steel cage inside a historic theater and thereby diluting the whole effect of having a historic theater.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why don't they get one of those on Broadway? Why don't they just go to the Roxy, the 1931 Art Deco Theater? It's empty in the back. It's got nothing in the front except
because
a couple
They don't have an imprint. They don't have a footprint in downtown. But we've got to come and we've got to do the walk of the perimeter of Netflix. I think they may right now have in Hollywood the largest studio in terms of geographic size. And it's in Hollywood proper, walking distance from the Sunset, or from the Hollywood Strip of historic theaters. So that's why they, you know, it's this idea of bringing back Hollywood that Netflix has been such a part of and that they want to continue. So I'm with you, but if we were to change geographic locale to Hollywood, the one that makes a lot of sense and that has been discussed before is the old Hollywood Pacific Theater, where you and I saw Spectres and where I had a ghostly experience.
You had the ghostly experience. Correct me if I'm wrong. The problem with that was parking. They needed a $31 million parking lot structure built beside it in order to come up to code. I believe that was the problem with that space.
I don't think, well, maybe for someone, but I don't think Netflix cares about that. There's lots in the area. I've heard that Warner Pacific simply won't sell. They simply will not sell. They're not interested in selling it. And which is terrible, but that would have been the win-win. That would have been, you know, buy that, refurbish that, and now Netflix, you're earning such
kudos,
gratitude. Yeah. And okay, even for those who are decrying what streaming has done to the movie business, as we've talked about, as if without Netflix, it never would have happened. But but those that decry it will at least say, oh, my God, you're preserving some of Hollywood history and an important part of Hollywood history. You're and you are showing movies in it. But they can't argue that with The Egyptian. They really can't, because this crown jewel had been restored. It had been all about celebrating the history of cinema. Yes, you're going to maintain it. You're going to keep it open. You're going to show movies, but you're taking what was and you're diminishing it.
Right.
And, so anyway, that's the one I wish that could somehow get figured out.
Yes.
Honestly.
What's happening? Well, I'm going down
or
in my head.
Or what if you want, okay, you want The Egyptian because you need it now, because maybe it's going to be a long process. And maybe Cinematheque does need an influx of cash, and the sale was going to help with that. But that would be my dream scenario is, okay, So here's what you're going to do. You're going to buy the theater from Netflix, and you're going to buy Netflix. You're going to buy it from the Cinematheque. You're going to buy the Egyptian, and you're going to buy for the Cinematheque the Pacific Theater in Hollywood, and you're going to refurbish it for them. That's my dream scenario, so that the Cinematheque would get the new home then. Anyway, because then Cinematheque would be more solvent. But anyway, those are my ideas. There's nothing more we can do. We had a lot of celebrity deaths to get to, but again, I was kind of slow rolling the trip to the morgue this week. but some greats to talk about. And so we'll open the show next week, because after all, I think more than just, for example, remembering the filmography of Peter Fonda, I think it's worth taking a look at our history and realizing that the Peter Fonda's death comes on the 50th anniversary of the opening of Woodstock. And there seemed to be some important symbolism in that,
right?
To me.
Yes.
So we'll wrestle with those ideas next week, Dean.
Absolutely. Look forward to that. That'll be something. Yeah, until then, you can hear every show we ever did, almost.
You can at Blog Talk Radio. We said, we're rebuilding Chilpack Hollywood. You know how to write us. People can like us on Facebook, can't they, Dean?
Oh, sure can. Facebook.com/Chilpack Hollywood. And follow us on Twitter and Instagram with the exact same handle, which is?
Dean and Phil.
Right. Spell out the word and.
Yeah. What could be more fun? That's it. Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Haglund. See you then.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.